Okay, there we go. Now it's on. Okay, part 2.5 of this series. Rabbi Goldberg just asked me when we're leaving, and I told him February 20th. So he said, why not parts 4, 5, and 6? I will say that you should just check your weekly. We'll see if I can do any others. It wouldn't be next week. It could possibly be in February. So you just check. If you don't see my handsome smiling face, then you know that hasn't happened. Since we're in the process of building concepts, I thought that once again it would be worthwhile to review what we have developed thus far. In the first lecture, I discussed the fact that paradigms die hard. People cling to paradigms with which they are comfortable, that they are accustomed to, and have grown accustomed to for many, many, many centuries. And it's difficult to give them up. We'll come back to this issue a bit more today. And so, one of the most famous and far-reaching and influential paradigms in the history of humanity, the paradigm of the geocentric universe, a paradigm which saw this Earth at the center of the universe, died very hard. In fact, people actually died as a result of suggesting a new paradigm, the heliocentric universe. And that's the paradigm we live with today. Why does it make a difference? Well, on the surface of it, it makes an enormous difference in one's view of themselves and their place in the universe. If you're at the center of things, it's very different than not being at the center of things. And this has had vast philosophical ramifications and theological ramifications throughout history. So paradigms are very, very important. And as I proceeded to say, the paradigm is the context within which you live, within which you function. And context is everything. And this is expressed most succinctly, most powerfully, in a verse in the Novi Yeshayahu, who states, "Mi bikesh zos miyadchem remos chatzeroi." Who asked you to bring these sacrifices through which you trample my courtyard? And of course, the obvious question is, who asked us to bring them? You, God, asked us to bring them. Yet, the Novi is teaching us that the context within which you bring them, which is expressed, which is captured metaphorically by the idea of a chatzer, of a courtyard, which forms the context for the building, the home, which sits within it, is the issue. You're trampling my courtyard, in spite of the fact that you're doing what it is that I've asked you to do. And the primary, the underlying principle of a Torah context is the concept of holism. This is expressed in the pasuk, "Pen tishkach es advorim asher ro'u einecha." We are forbidden to forget the things that our eyes saw. The things that our eyes saw, seeing the quality, the sense of vision, is holistic, as opposed to the other senses. When you see something, you see it in its entirety. And when one pixel of a picture changes, it changes not just that pixel, but the entire picture is now different. And this is why even seemingly harmless practices can lay waste to the entirety of Divrei Emes, of the words of truth, the paths of truth that we follow in the Torah, because there is no such thing as something small enough to be harmless. So the context must be built out of holism. And I pointed out to you that Moshe received an entirely new Torah with the second Luchos. After he destroyed the first Luchos, he needed a new period of 40 days to relearn the Torah, because the Torah that was given in the second Luchos was different in every way than the Torah that was given through the first Luchos, and it had to be relearned in its context. And therefore, as a result of the second Torah, the second Luchos, we have to go through a process of development of childhood, because creation is self-organizing. That's how I ended the first lecture, this idea of self-organization, self-development. So to review what I said last week, self-organization demands the ultimate degree of freedom. And this ultimate degree of freedom is defined by Rambam in Hilchos Tshuva. Man cannot be stopped once he has chosen to do something. You are creating yourself through choice. And without this principle, Rambam states, the entire Torah would have no meaning at all. And I pointed out to you the difference between choices and decisions. So most of us go through, a person can go through an entire life without making a single choice. We think we choose all the time. But choosing between McDonald's and Burger King, if you're invited to the White House, is not a choice. That's a decision. And decisions are chemically based, they're neuronally based. Oftentimes the decision is made for you by your nature before you've even intellectually, mentally recognized that you've made the decision. And all creatures make decisions from amoebas on up. They have processes through which decisions are made. Do I choose to follow the light? Do I decide to follow the light, to go after nutrition? An amoeba can make a decision like that. Most of us spend our lives making decisions, not choices. Choices are a matter of life and death. And I pointed out to you last week that the roots of this kind of freedom, to choose life or death, lies in creation itself. This is expressed in the verse, Yismach Hashem b'ma'asav, God rejoiced in his creation. When? The Talmud tells us, those of you who learned the Daf Yomi, it's coming up probably this week, Daf Samach and Chulin. It's the story of the growth of grasses, of vegetation. These grasses somehow, I didn't discuss the process, but somehow make a decision to grow according to their species, to preserve their genetic integrity, although they were not commanded to do so. Only the trees were commanded to sprout forth limineihem according to their species. But the vegetation made, as it were, a kal v'chomer, they reached a logical conclusion that they too must certainly grow discreetly with genetic integrity, because trees, after all, normally are they're large organisms. They are separate and distinct and discreet. Grasses grow in beirbuvia, in profusion. Very hard to tell the difference. Therefore, they said, if trees are commanded to grow this way, then we certainly, who grow naturally beirbuvia and confusion, should grow in such a way that we maintain our genetic integrity. So, this is a process that I described as heuristic, which means it is based on trial and error, on experimentation, and it takes many, many eons. Right? It's a process that we call evolution. It is unpredictable, and unpredictability is essential to life on Earth. Therefore, the creation of man is expressed remarkably as a question. Na'ase Adam, shall we make man? So the Midrash makes clear there was a discussion between God and the angels as to whether to do this. It becomes a statement, because the statement, and it's one of the Ma'amarim, one of the 10 definitive statements of creation, one of those Ma'amarim ends up being Na'ase Adam. The question is definitive. That is how we define man. He is always an open question and must remain so. Now, this presentation last week led to a series of very appropriate and important probing questions. If I can summarize the questions with which we left off, I would summarize it this way. If the universe is indeed self-organizing, bringing God into that kind of world would seem antithetical to that vision. It seems to stand in opposition to the vision of self-development, of self-organization, of self-fulfillment. There seems to be no place for a local God if it's all about me and my ability to create my own identity. Which also led to the question, the related question of, in such a world, a self-organizing world, what is the place of tefillah? What is the place of prayer? Now, my wife can attest to the fact that I spent the entire week attempting to prepare a presentation to answer these very important questions, an organized presentation. And I realized in the course of doing that two things. That number one, this is not the time, this is not the place yet to address those questions, even though the questions are burning, and they're very important questions. And if you really care about these issues, it's quite literally hard to sleep at night with questions like this. Nevertheless, I have to beg your indulgence, because I have come to realize over the course of these preparations that this is at least one lecture in and of itself, and I'm not at a point where it's appropriate to give that lecture. I did, however, remember in the course of thinking about this and working on this during all of last week, that I gave a lecture here almost 3 years ago. Date was February 28th, 2015, according to the website. The lecture is on the website, both BRS and YU Torah. It's on the website. And I would urge you If these questions are burning for you, I would urge you to listen to that lecture as a preparation for the answers to these questions, for which you will have to wait at least a year. Sorry. But next year, Mirza Hashem, if we're back, and there's another lecture series, or maybe in February, if it comes to that, I'll be able to present the lecture or lectures, probably plural, that are required to answer these questions and do justice to the answers. The shiur that I gave 3 years ago, which many of you may have attended, even if you did, believe me, the review is worthwhile because I reviewed it myself and I learned a lot. It's called Purim Probability and Free Will. It says that it's a daunting 1 hour and 22 minutes. However, the first several minutes were taken up by Rabbi Goldberg's very impressive introduction of me, which I urge you to listen to. But it's not really an hour and 22 minutes. It's really like an hour and a quarter, which probably doesn't make you feel much better, but it is, it's an extremely important part of the answer to these questions, of understanding the role of chaos and statistics in as the engine that drives creation. We're not accustomed to thinking of things in this way. In fact, we are accustomed to thinking of that statement as heretical. And, if you're here, I guess you'll have to trust me that it is not heretical, that it is actually, it actually is the engine that drives creation. And without understanding, as a preamble, how chaos and statistics drive creation, it is very difficult, if not impossible, to understand the answers to the questions about Hashgacha Pratit and the other issues that came up last week. So I suggest that as a means of preparation for the answers. So I'm going to pick up now where I left off, which is that after the creation of the first man, after the creation of the first man, history awaited the arrival of another man who would breathe life into humanity by embodying all of the ideas that we have been discussing that I just reviewed with you. That man was Avraham Avinu, who I described at the end of last week's lecture as the first freedom fighter. The Midrash observes that the words that were said to Avraham, these are not the right source sheets. You remember we left off in the middle last week.
Yes.
You guys don't even have the source sheets anymore unless you kept them from last week. These are the source sheets for the next lecture on Tefillah, which probably won't be the next lecture because I have to first do the lectures on Hashgacha Pratit before Tefillah. Well, anyway, it's just a few more trees. Nebuch. No, I'm sorry. If you don't have last week's source sheets, you'll just have to listen to me. You don't have the source sheets. I forgot about that. I should have collected them last week. Okay. Okay, so the Midrash observes that the words that were said to Avraham to introduce his first and last nisyonot, his first and last tests, were Lech Lecha. Right? The Midrash says, Rabbi Levi Omar, Lech Lecha nisayon rishon v'nisayon acharon, k'shem shayu b'nisayon rishon, kachaya b'nisayon acharon. Lech Lecha in both cases. These nisyonot, the first one, which was Lech Lecha Me'artzecha Mimoladetcha, leave your house, your homeland, etc., and the last one, the Akedah, Lech Lecha El Eretz HaMoriah, they seem to bear no relationship to each other at all. They seem to have nothing in common except these words. The stress, according to Rashi, is on lecha, for you. And this would take us to the next source, where, again, it's just two words. Rashi's comment on the words lech lecha is lahana ascha uletovascha. Literally, go for yourself, for your own benefit, for your own good. And there's an obvious play on words here. Lech lecha. They mean different things. Lech means to go, lecha means for you, but they're spelled exactly the same way. Lamed chof. So there's a play on words. Lech lecha. And this indicates that to go, to walk, to develop, is lecha. That is how you achieve something for yourself. By going, by developing. Most commentaries understand Rashi to mean that God says these words, Lech lecha me'artzecha, mimoladetcha, mibeisavicha, el ha'oretz asher areka, and then if you do that, I'll do all these wonderful things for you. I'll make you wealthy and famous, you'll have lots of children, etc. Most of the commentators understand Rashi to mean that God is persuading Avraham that this move is for his own good. I'm telling you to do it for your own good, and here's the incentive to persuade you that it is for your own good. You're going to become wealthy, famous, etc. The truth is, however, that any word that appears in the commandment, in the tzivui, is part of the tzivui. It's part of the commandment, and therefore becomes part of the nisayon. The lech lecha is nothing here is meant to be persuasive. The lecha is not just to persuade Avraham to be lech. It's going to be for you, so that's to persuade you to go. No, that is part of the commandment. Lech lecha is the commandment. So therefore, it is part of the challenge. It is part of the nisayon. And I've said to you in the past, we've discussed this many years ago, suppose Avraham would have responded by saying, please God, don't speak to me about going for my good. I want to do this l'shem shamayim. I want to do this for the sake of heaven, for you. And now you're ruining it by challenging me to do it for myself. In fact, Rambam derives the nature of avoda me'ahava, of serving God out of love, from Avraham Avinu, and states that one should never do anything for an ulterior motive, however noble, even to earn olam haba. And this would also be in your sources, where Rambam states, the worshipper, because of love, engages himself in the study of the Torah and the observance of precepts and follows the paths of wisdom on no account in the world, for no ulterior reason. Lo mipnei davar ba'olam. There's no ulterior motive, neither for fear of evil, nor in order to inherit the good, but he does the true thing because it is true, and in the end the good comes because thereof. And this is a very high madrega. It is not attained by all people. In fact, it is not attained by the vast majority of people, but for such was the degree of Avraham Avinu, who God called Ohavi, my beloved, the one who loves me. So you would think that Avraham would be correct in objecting. I don't want to do this for myself. I don't want to do this for some ulterior motive, for something in the world. I want to do this for you, l'shem shamayim. Instead, not only does Avraham not object, but in a remarkable verse in which God explains to us, the readers of the Torah, in a stage whisper, as it were, why he loves Avraham, he declares, "For I have singled him out, ki yadativ, that he may instruct his children and his posterity to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is just and right." Why should they do it? In order that the Lord may bring about for Avraham what he has promised him. And in case you don't understand that, Rashi tells us, in order that the Lord may bring, thus will he ever command his children, saying, these are the words that Avraham uses when he instructs his children. He tells them, keep the way of the Lord in order that the Lord may bring upon Avraham all the things that he promised. No. So, he commanded his children to follow the path of Hashem so that God would fulfill all the promises that he made to him. The great lover of God, Avraham Ohavi, becomes the one who not only accepts the notion that the promises are litovascha, for your good, and lahanascha, for your enjoyment, but he will only fulfill God's wishes, almanasken, for that purpose. Well, I believe that the only explanation for this apparent contradiction, a pretty startling contradiction, is that herein lies the essence of our relationship to God through Avraham. The Lech Lecha becomes God's offer of a relationship of brit, of covenant, to Avraham with the words, when Avraham was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to him and said to him, I am Kel Shakai, walk before me, Hishalech Lefanai, walk before me, Veheye Tamim, and be perfect. Walk in front of me. Don't wait for me to tell you what to do. Go ahead of me. Find your own way. This is the definition of Briso Shel Avraham, of the covenant with Abraham. The special brit with Avraham is to recognize that everything that you do has to be done only for yourself, and the moment that you feel you want to do your avoda, your service, l'shem shamayim, for the sake of heaven, you are violating Lech Lecha. The reason for this, I wasn't planning on saying anything controversial today. We'll get to it in a second, the obvious question. The reason for this, the underlying reason for this is that every person wants to do things l'shem shamayim. Everyone. Every jihadi martyr, every crusader, every kamikaze pilot is moser nefesh l'shem shamayim. It's all for the sake of heaven. Instead, God tells Avraham, if you love me, I'm asking you to give me the one thing, the one thing that I cannot give myself. The only gift that I can't give myself is you fulfilling yourself. If I complete you, then it's not you, it's me. You must self-realize. You must self-actualize. You must self-organize on your own, freely and independently. Therefore, Sfarno, in a remarkable comment on the words Veheye Bracha in the Tzivui to Avraham, the commandment to Avraham of Lech Lecha ends with the words, I'm going to give you all these wonderful things, fame, fortune, children, and then go out, Veheye Bracha, be a Bracha. Listen to these words of Sfarno. Incredible words. The Heye Bracha, this should resonate with what we talked about last week, Svarno says on the words, you shall be a blessing. Birchas Hashem hi. How do you bless God? She yismach Hashem b'ma'asav. That God will rejoice in his creations. The Talmudic story about the grass. Omar. Im kein. Heyeli bracha. God says, if you'll do this, you will be a blessing for me. By growing in awareness and becoming whole. That's the only thing I want. That's it. That's what you can give God. Sforno makes clear that Lech Lecha is the logical extension of Yismach Hashem b'ma'asav. The more you focus on the development of yourself, the better off you will be. Now, as we have stressed repeatedly, the only thing that the world could be for is the development of that which didn't exist before. Creation has no added value except for that which can create itself. The Irish songwriter, Enya, expressed this idea beautifully in her song, Pilgrim. She writes in that song, one way leads to diamonds, one way leads to gold. Another leads you only to everything you're told. In your heart you wonder, which of these is true? The road that leads to nowhere? The road that leads to you. The road that leads to you is the road taken by the pilgrim. And Avraham was the first and most important pilgrim in history. To be a pilgrim is to be a holech. A life of brit, of covenant, is about you. God would have said goodbye to Avraham if he had not embraced Lech Lecha. And this is the point, and this is why it's not contradicted by doing things L'Shem Shamayim, is because when we talk about doing things L'Shem Shamayim, we confuse the motivation with the goal. The goal is the fulfillment of you. Your motivation may be L'Shem Shamayim, but the goal... It's supposed to be L'Shem Shamayim. But the goal is the fulfillment of you. This is the ultimate. Lech Lecha is the ultimate L'Shem Shamayim. To be able to do this one chesed for God, because this is the only thing that we can give Him. The only thing that can possibly be added by creation that does not exist unless there is creation. Is this. For God, there's no difference between your potential and your actual. The only thing that could possibly be added by creation is the opportunity for something itself to become a creator. A human being who becomes a lecha is the L'Shem Shamayim. Yet every religion, including, and very sadly our own, teaches that we live to care for the poor or to be selfless towards others. And what are others living for? For other others. And this becomes an absurd, infinite regress until you get to the poor Schmendrick at the end of the line. He's got no one to live for. The truth is that in asserting such an approach to life, you are a parasite. You are, in effect, saying that your mitziut, your being, is nothing. But if you can do something for somebody else, then you can become something by absorbing some of the other person's mitziut. Perhaps you can even absorb some of God's mitziut, some of His being. And this is the significance of Rambam's history of the development of Avraham. Rambam says, again, this would be in your sources, he says, and on this path the world continues, he's giving the introduction to how we came to idol worship. And he says, on this path the world continued its course of circuity until the birth of the firmest pillar of the world, Abraham our father. As soon as this giant was weaned, he commenced to busy his mind. In his infancy, he commenced to think by day and by night. Moreover, he neither had a teacher nor one to import aught to him, for he was sunk in Ur of the Chaldeans among the foolish worshippers of stars. And he, although following them in their worship, busies his heart and reflects until he attains the path of truth, and by his correct thinking he understood when he finally saw the line of righteousness. And the Ra'avad, frequent commentator on Maimonides, on Rambam, asks, but I am amazed. Behold, there were their shame and aver. How have they refrained from raising a protest about all the idol worship and so on? Why was it only Avram? And as a corollary to that question, why was Avram Avinu alone? There was a tradition in the world, a Mesorah, from the time of Adam Arishon that was carried forward by Shem and Aver and their famous yeshiva. Why was Avram unaware of this? Why was he not influenced by this? But Rambam is making, in this history, the same point as Rashi makes in Lech Lecha. True, there was a tradition traceable all the way back to Adam. There was a yeshiva that taught this tradition. They personally knew a great deal, but they had no interest in developing the world. They never created anything. They were maintenance men. A world of maintenance men is a world shrouded in darkness. This is Rambam's description of the world at the advent of Avraham. It was dark and empty because nothing comes of such a world. What is the point of maintaining things? As Ramchal observes, and I showed you this source last year, actually twice in two different lectures, but its importance cannot be overstated, so I will therefore state it again. Ramchal teaches us in his discussion in the Das Tvunos between the Neshama, the book is constructed on as a discussion between the Neshama and the Seichel, the soul and the intellect, as it were. And the soul doesn't understand why reward and punishment is not sufficient. Why does the intellect keep talking about this thing called yichud, unity, oneness, holism? Why does he keep talking about that? And the Seichel explains to him that if the world were based entirely on reward and punishment, then it would be infinite. It would never end. Why do you think the world is on a 6,000-year plan? Why is there a beginning, a middle, and an end? Why is there a Bereshis and a Tachlis? Why? If it's all about souls earning a place in the world to come. So, the more the merrier. Let's have an infinite number of souls. Let it never end. Let's give an infinite number of people the opportunity to earn their Olam Haba. Why a limited number? Does God have a limited bank account? Is he going to run out of real estate? What's the problem? And Ramchal explains, because the world is purposeful, it is going somewhere. And therefore it is limited, it is entropic. It's going to end. There's a goal here. Ramchal observes that a world of maintenance men can cycle on forever. Forever, providing an infinite number of neshamot, opportunities to earn Olam Haba. Why end things at any point? Does God not have the wherewithal to keep this going infinitely? But a world of Lech Lecha is a world of change, a world of growth, a world of development. It has a beginning and an end that it must achieve. Our vision of biological life and of intelligent life is that of a world developing ever-increasing complexity. What would be the point of all that development and increasing complexity to such a degree if they are not definitive of the nature of creation? And this is all the logical extension of the concept of Yismach Hashem b'ma'asav, that God rejoiced in his creations when they moved out on their own. Did things on their own that were not part of the coded instructions. The only joy God has in creation is where he doesn't create it. And irony of ironies, and I'm going to give you here what I consider to be a particularly pithy line. Creation is the antithesis of creativity. Sadly, though, people, that would be us, don't want a world in which they're free. They don't want a world in which they have to discover themselves. They don't want a world in which there remain open questions. They don't want a world in which God doesn't do everything. They don't want a world that demands creativity. They don't want a world that must figure itself out. Yismach Hashem b'masov? Who asked you, God, to be happy? Let us be happy. People don't like such a world. And since they don't like it, they declare by executive fiat that it doesn't exist. Says one of my earliest, in fact, my earliest Rebbe used to say, we all fervently desire the Messiah, as long as he doesn't come on Super Bowl Sunday. We don't really want the Mashiach. We pay lip service to it. What's going to happen to our pizza shops? I mean, are we still going to be able to watch Netflix? We don't want to be shaken up. We don't want to grow and develop. We're perfectly happy and satisfied the way things are. Thank you very much. And we live with so many illusions. What we need more urgently than anything else is to be disillusioned. We think of disillusionment in a pejorative sense, but it's really the greatest thing that can happen to you. Consider the following famous story in the Talmud. And listen to the story carefully, because I'm going to ask you what the story is about, what you think the story is about. And this time I'm not going to prejudice anything. Tell me what you think the story is about, what it illustrates. Here's the story. The story is in Masechet Gittin, and it's a very famous story, one of the most famous in the Talmud. Here it goes. Rabbi Yochanan said, what is the meaning of that which is written in Mishle? Happy is the man who fears always, but he who hardens his heart shall fall into mischief. Jerusalem was destroyed on account of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. The place known as the King's Mountain was destroyed on account of a rooster and a hen. The city of Beitar was destroyed on account of a shaft or a fender from a chariot. So, I'm sure, like, you're familiar with the story of Kamsa or Bar Kamsa. The guy has a friend by the name of Kamsa, an enemy by the name of Bar Kamsa. He wants Kamsa invited to his feast. Bar Kamsa is mistakenly invited. He's sitting there. The guy comes over and says, "What the heck are you doing here?" And he says, "Well, please, I was invited." He says, "Well, get out. Please don't embarrass me. I'll pay for whatever I eat." "No, you got to leave. It's upsetting me too much." "Okay, I'll pay for half your feast, half the catering bill. Just don't embarrass me." "No, no, no, no. You have to go. This is too important to me. I don't want to see you here." "Okay, I'll pay for the entire catering bill. You drive a hard bargain. The whole catering bill." He said, "No." And he picks him up and throws him out. Now, many august Rabbonim were sitting there. They see this happen. They say nothing. Well, Bar Kamsa is, as you might imagine, ticked off. He says, "Look, I mean, they're all sitting there. And after having been cast from the feast, Bar Kamsa said to himself, since the sages were sitting there and did not protest the actions of the host, although they saw how he humiliated me, learn from it that they were content with what he did. I will therefore go and inform against them to the king." He went and said to the emperor, "The Jews have rebelled against you." The emperor said to him, "Who says that this is the case?" Bar Kamsa said to him, "Listen, I have an idea. Go and test them. Send them an offering to be brought in honor of the government and see whether they will sacrifice it." The emperor went and sent him with a choice 3-year-old calf. While Bar Kamsa was coming with the calf to the temple, he made a blemish on the calf's upper lip. And some say he made the blemish on its eyelids. A place, the point being, this is a place where according to us in Halacha, it is a blemish, but according to the Gentile rules for their offerings, it is not a blemish. Therefore, when Bar Kamsa brought the animal to the temple, the priests would not sacrifice it on the altar since it was blemished. But they also could not explain this satisfactorily to the Gentile authorities who did not consider it to be blemished. The blemish notwithstanding, the sages thought to sacrifice the animal as an offering due to the imperative to maintain peace with the government. Rabbi Zechariah ben Avkula said to them, "If the priests do that, people will say that blemished animals may be sacrificed as offerings on the altar." The sages said, "If we do not sacrifice it, then we must prevent Bar Kamsa from reporting this to the emperor." The sages therefore thought to kill him so that he would not go and speak against them. Rabbi Zechariah said to them, "If you kill him, people will say that one who makes a blemish on sacrificial animals is to be killed." As a result, they did nothing. Bar Kamsa's slander was accepted by the authorities, and consequently the war between the Jews and the Romans began. Rabbi Yochanan says the excessive humility of Rabbi Zechariah ben Avkulus destroyed our temple, burned our sanctuary, and exiled us from our land. Okay, what is this story about? What's the underlying problem in the story between of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa? What?
Pride. He was pride. He didn't want to be...
Pride?
Yeah, pride. And they should
I should have planted someone.
But he said he was... Bar Kamsa was some kind that he didn't accept. He's not invited, you know. He didn't want to be embarrassed. It's all about the ego also.
So it's Bar Kamsa's fault. As far as you're concerned, it's Bar Kamsa's pride.
Yeah,
anybody else have an idea? Yes.
Rabbi Zechariah didn't step up when it was a matter of Dikmakir and Derek Peretz, but when it was on Halacha, then he was dying.
Well, he might not have been there. I mean, it's possible, but he might not have been there. We don't know. Sages were at the party. We don't know that he was there. Yes?
The failure to see the big picture.
The failure to see the big picture. Okay. Okay. I expected everyone to suggest a different answer. You are correct, ultimately. What?
I think the sages got a lot to do with it.
The sages have a lot, they usually do. Usually to blame.
If they yes. would have been a little bit more understanding with Bar Kamsa, he would have taken it not so hard.
Nobody blames the host of the meal here?
Yes. The
host, not Bar Kamsa. What was the host doing?
Being dogmatic.
being dogmatic. Who knows? Who knows why the second Beis Hamikdash was destroyed? Sinas Chinam. Well, poor me. I thought everybody was going to say that this is an illustration. This story illustrates the problem of Sinas Chinam. You see how much this man hated Bar Kamsa, and therefore this ended up causing the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash, consistent with what the sages say in Maseches Yuma, that it was Sinas Chinam that destroyed the Beis Hamikdash. That's what I thought you would say, and then I would have a good time. But we all didn't fail. Say it. You're much smarter than that. But Sinas Chinam has nothing to do with this story. And I will pretty much guarantee you that if you ask most people who have learned this piece of Talmud what the problem is here, they will tell you it's Sinas Chinam. That has been my experience. But it has nothing to do with Sinas Chinam. Because the hint to that, among many hints, is that Rabbi Yochanan introduces this story, as well as two other stories, the rooster and the hen and the fender and the... With the following comment. Right? I've already read the comment, but I'm going to repeat it. Rabbi Yochanan said, "What is the meaning of that which is written? Happy is the man who fears always, but he who hardens his heart shall fall into mischief. Jerusalem was destroyed on account of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. The place known as the King's Mountain was destroyed on account of a rooster and a hen. The city of Beitar was destroyed on account of a fender from a chariot." Three cases of trivial incidents. Trivial incidents. A mistaken invitation, a rooster and a hen, and a damaged chariot fender. That all led to disasters. And here, we've already seen what the conclusion, the end of the Kamsa and Bar Kamsa story is. Rabbi Yochanan tells three stories to establish a pattern that has nothing whatsoever to do with Sinas Chinam, but has a great deal to do with the failure to consider the consequences of trivial things and living with illusions. And indeed, it can be expressed as the failure to see the big picture. Now, the names Kamsa Ubar Kamsa hint to this. They literally mean, the literal meaning of Kamsa is an ant. An ant. Not your ant, an ant. A-N-T. An ant. And Bar Kamsa is even more trivial. It's the baby ant. It's the child of the ant. Something meaningless. Roosters and hens and fenders and trees and ants. It's all a joke. And these jokes destroy everything. The same Rabbi Yochanan who introduced this discussion by citing the verse from Proverbs, "Ashrei Adam Mefachei Tamid, happy is the man who is always worried," now, strangely, condemns Rabbi Zechariah ben Avkulus for being worried. He's worried about everything, Rabbi Zechariah ben Avkulus. What will people think? What will people say? They'll say that that you're allowed to bring a blemished animal. They'll say that if you do bring a blemished animal, the punishment is death. It's a capital crime. These are incorrect. These are errors. That's a terrible thing. He's afraid. He's worried. Everyone else knew what to do about Bar Kamsa. Kill him. But Rabbi Zechariah prevents them from acting because of his worries and apprehensions. Why then is Rabbi Zechariah the villain of the piece? Based on the verse cited by Rabbi Yochanan, he should be held up as an example of virtue. The reason he isn't, and is in fact held up as a counterexample to virtuous behavior, is because the verse cited, the proof text, stresses that virtue lies in worrying tamid, ashrei adam mefached tamid. Tomim. Not Ashrei Odom Mefached, but Ashrei Odom Mefached Tomid. Always. Don't tell us what you think we must be worried about. Tell us what we really must be worried about. You, Rabbi Zechariah, base your worries on the assumption that the Beit HaMikdash is invulnerable. It is a given that will always be there. Your grandfather and his grandfather and his grandfather for century after century have had a Beit HaMikdash. Rabbi Zechariah thought, can we seriously think that Bar Kamtza is going to bring it down? So, what we really must worry about is giving the wrong impression to people about the halakha. In retrospect, we see that he was tragically misguided. His concerns are simply crazy. These are the things he's worried about? That people might think that you're allowed to bring a blemished animal as a sacrifice? Or people might think that the punishment for bringing a blemished sacrifice is execution? That's what he's worried about? It's like worrying about smartphones and insisting that if we have kosher phones, oh, then all of our problems will be solved. The problems of Klal Yisrael will be solved by that. We ought to say to Rabbi Zechariah, we are facing the loss of the entire country, including the Beit HaMikdash. We are facing a situation in which within a generation or two, nobody will know what a blemished sacrifice is. Forget whether they will think that the penalty for blemishing a korban is death. They won't know what a blemish is, or what a korban is for that matter. Rabbi Yochanan teaches us to look at our assumptions and the kinds of things that we are worried about because of those assumptions that make it impossible to deal with reality. The nechama, the consolation of the post-Churban period makes it possible to embrace a new paradigm. And so we come full circle, at least in this lecture series, these two lectures. Max Planck, a founding father of quantum mechanics, famously said, quote, "A scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die and a new generation grows up that is familiar with it." Remarkably, the model for Planck's statement is the Dor HaMidbar, the generation of the desert. An entire generation had to die out before Yisrael could enter the land of Israel. The old generation simply could not accept the new paradigm that life in Eretz Yisrael represented. Pasuk says in Devorim, "Vayehi kasher tamu kol anshei hamilchama lo mus mikerev ha'om." When all the warriors among the people had died off, then the Lord spoke to me, saying, "Start moving to Eretz Yisrael. You are now passing through the territory of Moab, etc." Only after the entire generation dies was it possible to begin the march into Eretz Yisrael. George Harrison plaintively wrote, "While my guitar gently weeps, with every mistake we must surely be learning, still my guitar gently weeps." True genius is to let go of preconceptions and illusions and see things as they are and to allow oneself always to be disillusioned. The solution does not apply in temporary fixes. It is necessary to discover what all the underlying issues are, and we will continue that effort the next time that we meet, whenever that may be. As I said, look to your weekly, maybe not in February, we'll see. If not, I look forward to next winter, Amir Tzah Hashem.